Accession number 27084, Reel 6.
So Benjamin, we were talking about Edward Ashmore, and you were talking also about the job of naval assistant. If you'd like to pick up there, if you
yes,
would.
And I think I was saying about the when we left off the relationships within the office that I had with my time with as naval assistant with Edward Ashmore, it was absolutely fascinating. We did some very interesting trips, and the great thing about the naval assistant is he does the travelling, the secretary stays at home. And particularly I can remember a trip to Japan and the Far East with Edward, which was absolutely fascinating, seeing the sort of high level military diplomatic relationships. And it was you learnt a lot on that, and it was something which in later years, you cast your mind back and sort of said, how would Edward have played it, and things like that. So it was a very interesting period. And of course, we visited ships, and as I said, that Edward was very demanding. There was no doubt about it that a visit by the First Sea Lord. Ships were slightly apprehensive as to how it would go, but he was always very quick to praise a ship that had done well. He was also, I think, probably he was never fulsome in his praise, but that was the nature of the man, and he believed that you could say well done in about two or three words. And that, again, in terms of sort of brevity and all his staff work, was remarkably accurate, concise, and to the point. And again, a very good example. And there was no waffle with Edward. And watching him deal with some of the nuclear aspects in the nuclear politics in the MOD, it was an absolute education. He couldn't have been kinder to me, and he was great fun to travel with, and it was a tremendous privilege to have worked with him, or for him. And then, of course, Andrew Humphrey, the chief of the Air Staff, CDS designate, fell ill and died. And then, of course, Edward was sent to be CDS for 6 months. In the meantime, so Terry Lewin left Portsmouth early, where he'd been the commander-in-chief, to come and take over. And it was...
As First Sea Lord.
And it was quite interesting. You had to adjust your style and way of doing things overnight to meet the needs of a completely different personality.
Well, I see. You didn't go with Edward.
No. Because he didn't. He had a Rowley Guy, Brigadier Rowley Guy, who is now general, was the green jacket personal staff officer, sort of the head man in the office. Of course, because CDS was a purple job, you had a tri-service staff. And so stayed on with Terry Lewin. And again, an absolutely fascinating time, because you saw another way of doing things, and their styles were completely different. But in terms of getting the job done and knowing the business, they were both equal. Terry's interest in history was obviously, I think, slightly stronger and more obvious than Edward's was. He again was a delightful man to work with. He attached tremendous importance, which for someone who lived in Somerset was a good thing, to getting away from the MOD promptly on a Friday afternoon, So that was a tick in the box as far as I was concerned. Again, I had some fascinating travel with him to South America, to Brazil, on a visit there. Somewhere where I'd probably never have seen otherwise.
Can you give an example between the difference between not only their styles, but their, if you like, their operational way of going about getting the same thing done or getting the same result, but obviously doing it quite differently?
Well, it was described to me once. Someone, some admiral said, I'll tell you the difference, he said, between Edward and Terry. Edward goes through life thinking that everybody has got their head below the mud, and occasionally a head pops up and he's delighted. Terry Lewin goes through life that everybody's heads are above the mud, and when one sinks below the other in quick succession, he's very disappointed. And it was to a certain extent, there's quite a lot of truth in that. Terry was tremendously optimistic and believed the best in everybody. Edward, not in the nicest possible way, believed that quite a lot of people had quite a lot of failings, and they needed to be, as it were, helped around their troubles. But Edward was quite unforgiving with senior officers. That was, you know, junior flag officers who he felt should be doing better. Terry Lewin was equally critical, I'm sure, but didn't let it show so much.
Yet still managed, presumably, to get out of that junior flag officer what he wanted.
Oh, yes, yeah. But, you know, Terry Lewin had immense charm. You know, I enjoyed working for both equally.
Which is the better way of operating, in your judgment?
I can put them into a blender.
And if you're, I'm going to press you on this, if you're not able to put them into a blender and you have to choose?
I think probably Terry Lewin's. Probably. But I think if you asked someone who wasn't on Edward's personal staff that question, they'd probably go much more quickly to Terry Lewin. If you have been close to the person and seen what really he was trying to do and the reasons that he was doing it, you're much more forgiving. He had a marvellous brain, Edward. I mean, his specialist knowledge of communications and everything and warfare was probably better than Terry's. Strategically, I think they were both sort of equal. They both got a very good strategic grasp. Dealing with ministers, Terry was much more emollient than Edward was, and I think was less confrontational.
And that is important, isn't it?
Again, it depends what you're being confrontational about. I mean, I know that's slightly ducking the thing, but there's no point in having rows about unimportant things with ministers. They're okay, and you've... We were talking about ministers, and...
We were.
You probably only got one or two chances of changing ministers' minds by being confrontational and having a row. It's rather like, as we talked about... later on the Chief of Staff Committee, going across the road to seeing the Prime Minister. You can only do it once. It's not a shot. You can keep on playing and playing and playing. You've got to pick your moment.
Yes. The thing that I have noticed from the cycle of interviews I've conducted so far is that it's really these things, the inability of many ministers, most ministers, to understand really what the real issues of defence are. Mm. So they always have to be educated and educated very quickly. And the overriding control, irrespective of the of the quality and calibre of your minister in the MOD at a technical and operational level, the overriding control that the Treasury have in ultimately making decisions, irrespective of what the chiefs of staff and their ministers might want.
Yes, I mean, yes, and the degree of treasury control depends very much, I think, on the influence of the permanent undersecretary. You know, if the treasury know that there's a really tough PUS, I think, I mean, Frank Cooper used to take them head on. And also, you depend on the weight that your Secretary of State carries in Cabinet. A tough Secretary of State of Defence. Again, the Chancellor is he's not going to waste his time dealing with too long, dealing with someone who's so determined to get his way that who he feels has got the ear of the Prime Minister. A lot of the time, I mean, the Treasury do back away. You've got to catch their moment. They were on the back foot after the Falklands. And, I mean, I'll come to it when we talk about DNAW. But, you know, there are opportunities to grab as many sweets off the counter as you can before the shutters come down on them. And the skill, I think, is picking those moments when you find that there's a general bending. I mean, there was in my time as first when the tide flowed for various reasons, which I'll come to, in favour of the Tomahawk, and we grabbed it. But overall, my time in the First Sea Lord's office was a great education. I think I did it reasonably competently, and it was a privilege working for both of those two. And then after my time as naval assistant, I was appointed captain of the 5th Frigate Squadron and command of HMS Minerva. HMS Minerva was going through a long modernisation at Chatham. However, just before I was appointed to her, we'd sold our London house and decided to move down here on the basis, I said, of I'll never get a Chatham ship. And then found myself with a ship in deep dockyard hands, commuting at the weekends between Chatham and Somerset. So that was an awkward decision. Anyway, pulling Minerva out of modernisation and sea was a long old process. During our machinery trials, I can remember it now, it was Guy Fawkes Day, and the morning of Guy Fawkes Day at about 5:30 in the morning, we were sailing from Portsmouth on the Monday morning.
This is 74.
We're up 78. Yes, we've got, by the time the first year, you see, I did command of Ariadne 75, then Naval Assistant First Sea Lord 76, 77, and then in the spring of 78, I left the First Sea Lord's office.
Of course,
To take Minerva. So we're talking about later in 78, doing the machinery trials, Monday morning, due to sail at 8 o'clock from Portsmouth for more trials. It was the most tremendous bang that woke me up, and one of the boilers had blown up due to a slight confusion in the boiler room, and so we had the ignominy of the tow back to Chatham, even the tug managed to take the wrong buoy going up the Prince's Channel and very nearly took us aground. I felt like it might get away with the boiler explosion, but a boiler explosion and a grounding, even under tow, might have finished my career. We eventually got going sail, went down to Portland, did the workup, and then did various jobs. We did a bit of shadowing Russian submarines as they came down the west coast of Ireland. It was in the period when Maggie had just taken charge, where there was a hardening of attitudes to the Soviet Union. And, I mean, we always did follow things, but the feeling was that we were, not to be aggressive, but certainly to show the Soviets that we control these waters, and although they're international waters, if they wanted to go through them, we probably knew they were there. And so there was quite a lot of the marking and shadowing of the of the Russians. We had a happy time in the Mediterranean, and my period in command with the frigate squadron, you had the other ships to look after as well, and nothing terribly exciting happened. But there was the challenge of running a happy ship. We went through Portland three times in the correct sequence of the basic sea training, the intermediate sea training, and then back again. And we came out pretty well from that. And so that was very, very satisfying. And we got a certain amount of sort of foreign visiting, which was all great fun in the Mediterranean, including particularly good visit to Corfu, which was.
Do you have to work up as a frigate squadron?
No, I mean, this was the trouble. There was a lot of debate as to exactly what the having this layer of management. You had your there was the fleet by that stage only one from northward. Then you had your flag officer flotillas, who had a staff at Portsmouth who did the operational sort of standards of your ship. Then you went down to the Captain F level, who was, again, trying to improve the operational capability of ships, which weren't all of the same type. It was different in the old days. The destroyer squadron went around more or less as a six of them. They all came into Malta together and they all left together. Now, quite often you didn't see your fellow ships or even work with them, and so it was quite a difficult job to do. I think the most important thing about being Captain F was that you were the reporting officer for their. You were in the chain of reporting for the commanding officers and also the first lieutenants and the heads of department, and you could influence. You were able to assess which were the good chaps, probably closer than the flag officer flotilla could, and so there was contribution there. And quite frankly, I think judging the sort of the management of the ship and its competences, who were the weak links, was the most important job of the Captain F. And we did all
not only in his own ship, but in the other.
In the other ships, yes. It was the other ships more that one was interested in. So that was I enjoyed my time in Minerva. As I say, it was modest. I had a good team of officers, and we had a reasonably happy time with the right balance between operations, visits, and in between.
Yes.
And so that took me up to the end of 1980, and in 1981 I went to the Royal College of Defence Studies, and the RCDS was, I mean, the aims of the RCDS really were to give you a breather for those that were going on to the higher command. It was an ability to sort of take stock of your career so far and what you'd learnt, and then how you're going to apply all that to the higher levels that you all people hoped that you'd be going on to. You also probably for the first time met the other two services and got to know them. As an aviator, I had already got to know the Air Force quite well and knew what they were about, but I hadn't really met the Army apart from the garrison in Gibraltar. So it was the first time you came up, as it were, against the warriors of the Central Front. And understood what made them tick. And of course, some people had come across the Army in Northern Ireland, but on the whole, this was the time to get to know the soldiers of your contemporary soldiers, with whom you were going to be working closer and closer in the years to come. And, of course, then there was the foreign element of the RCDS, where you had the people who were going on, in a lot of countries' cases, to people who were going to the higher ranks of their armed forces. And these were relationships and friendships which you banked and you could draw on later, you hoped.
But there was a very small pool of officers, wasn't there, from each country in each service? Would that
yes,
be right?
I mean, there were about six or seven naval officers from the Royal Navy, and each country sent, the old Commonwealth sent two, Slav three, some countries like Belgium, obviously, only one. But it was fairly tightly controlled, the foreign element. The great thing about the RCDS was that it was an unclassified course because of the foreign thing, which actually therefore meant one didn't get into anything too serious, or too UK oriented operational. And it was a great way of. I mean, we were just starting to get interested in Islamic politics and what was happening there, and you had, real life people from those countries who could explain it, or at least put their point of view.
Yes.
One had on the course, we had both a Greek and a Turk, and we both had an Israeli and members from the Arabs, and seeing their relationships going, which always seemed to be actually far more cordial than one might have thought. They did grow, and one likes to think that they will have seen it as an opportunity to have seen the other side. And also they got exposed to the international view of their attitudes. In other words, not much quarter was given by visiting lecturers as to what they thought of one side or the other. And that was quite good for them to hear it, that there was another point of view.
And these visiting lecturers were drawn from the principal universities, I would have thought, or not?
But they were the movers and shakers in their respective fields. I mean, people like Edward Luttbach came, and we got quite a few ex-ambassadors who were sort of specialists in their subject. Rosemary Hollis came on international law, and they were a very high standard of lecturer, and we ended up, I saw the last day with the Secretary of State, the last 2 days, Secretary of State, CDS, and Foreign Secretary, and so you got some good. We had Robert Armstrong, the Secretary of the Cabinet, he came down and talked. But the interesting thing was, because you got the experts, they were very definite in response to questions. And we had the greatest expert, and I can't remember who it was, on Germany. And I asked a question about, given communications now and isn't it inevitable that the two halves of Germany will want to get back together? This was 1981. And no, he said, it was absolutely out of the question. The West was happy. West Germany was happy as it was. East Germany was happy as this was. The world was got just the relation. The most awful chaos would ensue if we tried to encourage reunification. It was off the menu for as long as he could see.
And about 10 years, as it turned out.
Yes. Yeah. So it was. It's quite interesting looking back at some of the definite pronouncements that were made by the expert, and I suppose it made one fairly cynical. But the RCDS was fun, and one made a lot of good friends, and it did broaden your mind. It got you delving into to areas which you wouldn't have otherwise. The regional tour, which you did, I went up to Yorkshire and Humberside, and that was fascinating, going round industry there, going down a coal mine and things like that. The foreign tour, we went to various regions of the world. I'd seen quite a lot of the other areas, and so, in fact, I I didn't get my first choice, which was China. There was a visit to China, but I didn't get that. But I got, so I've selected as my second choice, really by tactical voting, because I knew I'd get it, which was Northern Europe, because I'd never really seen Germany and the inside of Germany. And I'd obviously been to France on holiday, and Holland and Finland, I think we went to, or was it Sweden? Sweden, I think. Anyway, had a very interesting 4 weeks there. Again, talking to quite a lot of experts, been very well looked after by the countries concerned, and so that was a great experience. And then we did a separate visit to Berlin, and also to BAOR, and again it gave one a chance to look at the Central Front, and there was no doubt about it. One was very much struck by how much army that we had got over in Germany at the time, and the huge staffs at Rheindahl and Bielefeld. But that was how things were. And so at the end of 1981, by which time there's been John Knott's defence review, with the carriers about to be sold, or at least put on the defence data, certainly one, if not possibly two, the fleet air arm really heading south, as it were, and not looking as if it got a great future, and general gloom and doom. I went to the MOD as the Director of Naval Air Warfare, and when I took up the job, the only prospect really was the replacement for the Sea King, the Merlin, which was an Anglo-Italian project, and that was about the only new thing we were buying. And the rest was a question of how do you run it all down and get rid of the carrier, phase out the Sea Harrier, etc., etc. However, 6-7 weeks later, that was all to change when the Falklands brewed up. Quite interesting, looking at who knew what when. I can remember going to the VCNS, who was William Staveley's, morning prayers with the directors of the naval staff. And beginning of February, he and John Fieldhouse of the CNC Fleet were getting concerned, and we were told, the directors were given a sort of general instruction of, I think we ought to dust off the Falklands contingency plans. And because I wasn't in on the higher levels of intelligence, I don't know. I have a feeling that the signs were there even more than the Franks inquiry came up with. I think that there was much more writing on the wall then than the politicians were prepared to acknowledge. Anyway, we had the Falklands crisis, and it was quite clear to me that the only way in which we were going to get air down there was via the carriers. And I can always remember being recalled. I came down the weekend, and no sooner had I arrived than we got the call to all go back to London. And meeting Henry Leach on the steps of the MOD, or inside the, one of the floors, with the light of battle in his eye, I suppose I shall never forget it. And my job was to get all the necessary bits of the fleet air arm together and try and grab everything we could, expand everything we could to get the necessary, you know, helicopters from everywhere, form new squadrons, get everything moving. And really we saw it as very much, not only was there a job to be done, which we had to do properly and win, but also that they were going to have to rethink the carrier decision after this. I think the one working as on sort of Henry Leach's inner staff, the naval staff directors did, was a tremendous experience. I think how lucky we were to have had both Terry Lewin and Henry Leach in their various slots at the time, and the fact that they had both been through World War II, when we started losing ships. For us directors, we'd never been in a navy that had lost a ship. And they held their nerve, steadied the politicians, and they also steadied us. They were very much, yep, well, we lost ship, it was get on with the job. You knew what must have been going on inside them, but they never looked nearly as worried as perhaps we did. And it was a tremendous example of leadership, I thought. I think that I got involved with the AEW seeking, in that we had an opportunity there, and Westlands came up, and so I pushed that through, and we got that on going. We got Argus, the RFA.
This is a sort of helicopter-borne AWACS.
Airborne early warning with the radar. There was the RFA Argus, which was converted container ship made into a helicopter carrier, which we pushed through, and that's still around, and that concept's gone. The only point where I think it was